This is my conversation with Dr. Rodrigo Nunez, author of Neither Vertical Nor Horizontal, A Theory of Political Organization, as well as the public books essay, Are We in Denial About Denial? My conversation with Dr. Nunez today will look at neoliberalism, denialism, and the shape of political forms, questions, and economies to come. Dr. Nunez and I discuss the current form of neoliberalism, as well as defining what that nebulous term actually means. We discuss why seemingly unpopular leaders and policies like neoliberalism, as well as the unpopular rulers who inflict it, like a Donald Trump, Jair Bolsonaro, and others, continue to gain in popularity, and what a post-neoliberal future might look like and how this might be even more daunting and destructive than the present issues we face globally. It's a fascinating conversation about political questions and organizations, and I was thrilled to be joined by Dr. Nunez to discuss them. For more conversations like this, you can go to our back catalog on the Arts of Travel podcast on Apple and Spotify. We have fascinating conversations with a variety of global thinkers. You can also go to our website, asiaarttours.com, for print interviews and articles. We have a profile from Eric Margolis on Japan's Kyohei Sakaguchi and his beautiful artwork. Here's my conversation now with Dr. Rodrigo Nunez on neoliberalism, denialism, and the shape of things to come. I hope you enjoy our conversation today.
So my name is Rodrigo Nunez. I'm a professor of modern and contemporary philosophy at the Pontifical Catholic University of Rio de Janeiro in Brazil. I have one of the subjects on which I've worked the most in the last decade has been political organizations. So I have a book on this that came out in 2014 called Organization of the Organizationless, which was directly about that cycle of protest that began with the Arab Spring in 2011. And I have a new book coming out very soon in a couple of months with Verso called Neither Vertical Nor Horizontal, A Theory of Political Organization. But I guess the main reason why I'm here talking to you today is a piece that came out with Public Books very recently called Are We in Denial About Denial? Which is basically a commentary on the response to COVID in the US and Brazil and the rise of the far right and what might be the things about the far right that we are, or about the grip that the far right has had on the imagination of a surprising amount of people that we haven't yet understood.
So to start your essay on Public Books, I think this is actually, for me, the most interesting quote. It's the longest one, and I'm just going to quote it in full. I read quickly. So this is the start of a block quote. For me, the defining image of the 2008 financial meltdown was Alan Greenspan, one of the chief architects of the deregulation that had made the subprime catastrophe possible, confessing to the United States Congress that he had been forced to revise one of his most fundamental assumptions, that the search for profit would never override the survival instincts of supposedly rational economic agents, exposed in its very logic by market irrationality, stripped of its normative claims by the brazenly unmerocratic denouement of the crisis, lacking a plausible New Deal to offer to the vast majority of people. Neoliberalism seemed to be hemorrhaging legitimacy from all sides. Like many around that time, I too find it hard to believe that it could survive the shock. And yet a decade later, several further shocks later, neoliberalism staggers on, end quote. And there's an ellipsis there because you have a good description of Wall Streeters packing up, you know, their offices at Goldman and Bear Stearns. So as a layperson, particularly one who's familiar with outlets like Verso or Pluto and things like that, you know, you can really talk about QAnon, probably like the QAnon for the left is all the books and publications and tomes that have been written about neoliberalism. There's very detailed scholarship on it, people like Quinn Slobodian and Philip Murkowski. For me, as a layperson who's not a scholar, I found that very hard and difficult to sort of understand what their point is. Whereas when I look at sort of the more blunt criticisms of a Wendy Brown or a Naomi Klein, with the former in her prior book talking about how neoliberalism thrives on undone or undoing democracies, and the latter's sort of shock doctrine talking about neoliberalism generating its own crisis, thriving on that chaos, and then it becomes this sort of never-ending Ouroboros of pain and misery. I struggle to sort of think about how something like neoliberalism could end, because that's my frame of reference, this system that thrives in chaos and pain and instability. So could you help me fill in some of the gaps here? When you're talking about your own vision of how neoliberalism might have ended, what did that mean? How can a system like neoliberalism actually end?
Well, that's the several-trillion-dollar question, not in the sense that whoever answers it will get that money, but probably in the sense that if we find the answer, that would wipe out that much value from the assets of the super rich. I think you're quite right to highlight the ways in which crisis is central to neoliberalism and what makes it so hard to kill once it actually feeds off and thrives in crisis situations. I would say crisis is central to neoliberalism in at least three ways. The first is that historically, neoliberalism has taken and takes advantages of situations of crises, or effectively creates them in order to introduce wholesale restructuring. And there's an irony here in that the centrist consensus that was built around neoliberalism since the 1990s sells us the idea that any politics that isn't gradualist is populist, is radical, etc. But neoliberalism has always been a form of radical reformism, right? It's always been about taking the opportunity to implement as many reforms as fast as you can. So it's never actually been a particularly gradualist form of politics. The second way in which crisis is central to neoliberalism is that since the professed goal of neoliberalism is to approximate an ideal market or to approximate ideal market conditions that are recognized to be an ideal structure, right? I.e. the ideal market is actually something that can only be approximated but never attained in real life. It only exists as an ideal structure. Then every crisis that neoliberalism produces can always serve as an excuse for more neoliberalism. So you have a huge market failure, what they would call market failure, as we had in 2008 with the subprime crash, that happens as a consequence of deregulation. And the neoliberal response will be to say, it didn't happen because there was too little regulation, but because there was still too much, because we still weren't close enough to this ideal structure, to this chimera, an ideal market that we're pursuing. And since you never fully eliminate the state, there's always more states to eliminate. So each crisis can be used as an excuse to increase the dose of the remedy rather than changing remedy or rather than prescribing an antidote to what has caused the crisis. And the third way in which crisis is central to neoliberalism is that crisis is ultimately, in terms of both narrative and policy, neoliberalism's greatest disciplinary mechanism. Narratively, in the sense that since the 1970s, neoliberalism has always presented itself as a kind of tough love hangover cure. You know, the discourse has always been, and this comes back, this is reactivated every time there is a crisis. Well, excesses were committed in the past, namely, always the most egregious excess for neoliberals is increasing people's welfare in general. So excesses were committed in the past. The situation got out of hand. Now you have to take responsibility. You have to tighten your belt, etc. So that's always the narrative that gets reactivated with every crisis. And it's the narrative with which neoliberalism was presented for the first time in the late 70s. And crisis is a disciplinary mechanism in policy terms because that's precisely when they pass their most ambitious reforms with the excuse that excesses were committed, that now we have to tighten the belt, that now we have to take responsibility for our own lives. And because the point of these reforms is always the privatization of risk. Is always like, well, no one is going to help you out. There's not going to be any safety net for you. You're out on your own. You sink or swim. You die or you survive, depending exclusively on your own wits. And this has been going on for decades now, that both the discourse and the introduction of ever more policies that point in this direction. So this is very much internalized in the way that the vast majority of people think and perceive themselves. On top of that, public discourse is still completely taken by neoliberal dogmas. So in Brazil, for the last 5 years, they've passed a number of reforms, and every time they present the reforms, politicians and market analysts will say, oh, this reform is going to create several million new jobs, this reform is going to increase GDP by X percent. None of that has happened. Every single time, what was promised didn't happen. But when that fails to materialize, there's no damage to the credibility of the politicians, of the market analysts, the economists, etc., who said those things. So why would they bother tell the truth? Is no one holding them to account on those things in public discourse and particularly in the media? And at some point, maybe 4 years ago, in one of these, during the process of passing one of these reforms in Brazil, there was a poll, which I thought was very representative of this predicament that we're in, where people were asked whether they supported the reform. I think it was a labor reform. So people were asked whether they supported the labor reform, and I remember this particular result in the polls, where people were asked, "Do you think the reforms will be good for you?" And the majority of people said no. "Do you think the reforms are necessary?" And the majority of people said yes. So this is what we're talking about in a nutshell, like a twisted form, the way in which neoliberalism has produced this twisted form of civic virtue, where lots of people are up for sacrifice, but understand that this sacrifice will only ever be their own, that they will always be the ones who will be told, oh, you have to tighten your belt now. And they'll go, oh, well, this is what we have to do. We'll just have to tighten our belts because there is no other option. And obviously, all the time you're told, heaven forbid anyone touches the billionaires. Heaven forbid anyone ever tells the billionaires to tighten their belts. So how do you get out of that? We thought that a huge shock like 2008 would be enough. Many of us thought that, and that made some sense in light of an obvious or two obvious historical parallels, which is the rise of Keynesianism at the end or in the wake of the 1929 crash and the Great Depression at the start of the 1930s. And then the end of Keynesianism with the 70s stagflation crisis and the rise of new liberalism. So we thought, well, once an economic theory that's taken hold of policy to that extent is shown to be at fault according to its own logic, then surely it will have to go. And that didn't happen. One of the reasons, maybe, certainly one of the main reasons why that didn't happen is, I think, because there wasn't a split between different fractions of capital in the same way that you had in the 1930s and in the 1970s, where in the 1930s you had industrial capital taking over again from financial capital, or taking advantage of the fact that financial capital was being reined in, and then finance taking over from industrial capital again at the end of the 70s. The difference now is that the proliferation of derivatives and the huge proliferation of finance instruments means that that there isn't that much of a difference between financial and industrial capital anymore, i.e. Industry has moved into finance quite heavily. So their interests are not, the interests of finance and industry are not that incompatible, because industry now makes, possibly in several cases, makes more money in finance, or at least makes more money for the capitalist in finance than it actually makes in terms of industrial performance. Which also means that, you know, because people make money out of these this complex structure of derivatives that is this complex speculative structure that's built on top of the real economy, so it's only peripherally connected to the real economy. This means that people can make lots of money even when the capitalists can make lots of money even when the real economy is tanking. So they're a lot less concerned with the performance of the real economy now than they were in the 1930s and in the 1970s. So really, the only response would seem to be a groundswell of mobilization from below. And something like that did actually begin to happen around 2011 with the Arab Spring, with Occupy, with the Indignados in Spain, and so on. And what happened was that the global capitalist class, which may act shocked now when they watched the invasion of the Capitol in Washington in the news, but they were actually happy, and often more than happy. They aided and abetted the rise of the far right. precisely as a way of capturing those energies that began to erupt around the start of the last decade. So we can wait for fractures to appear within the global ruling class or between the global ruling class and the far right, but I'm not sure that will happen anytime soon, and the human cost of that would be enormous. So the only alternative today is, I believe, to start organizing again, starting from the bottleneck that the vast majority of people experience in social reproduction, i.e., you know, the difficulties that most people experience in continuing to lead their lives because the economy and governments have basically left them out of their own to fend for themselves. So yeah, it's not a great answer, but that's really the only way out that I could imagine now.
From your essay, you say the following on the far right. To put it bluntly, if the far right has managed, through the use of disinformation or otherwise, to mobilize the anti-systemic feelings of people who feel they have been failed and left behind, it is because those sentiments exist. Ellipses. Combating this message, therefore, it is not just a matter of fighting deception, it is ultimately about addressing the issues that are at the source of those feelings. So, as an American, I was trying to find a quote. There's so many angry people in the marginalized people in the history of our literature and writing because we're a pretty fucked up country. But this is Baldwin on whiteness in America. America became white by slaughtering the cattle, poisoning the wells, torching the houses, massacring Native Americans, raping black women. This moral erosion has made it quite impossible for those who think of themselves as white in this country to have any moral authority at all, privately or publicly. And to link this back to our earlier sort of musings on neoliberalism, something I'm curious about, both with sort of the violence and vulgarity in the literal sort of words and deeds of people like Bolsonaro and Trump, coupled with the violence and vulgarity more abstractly of their economic policies, in many countries that are strongly leaning into neoliberalism, the UK, Modi's India, Trump's America and Biden's America and Bolsonaro's Brazil, we see this co-rise that maybe it's coincidental, but I still want to ask you, of sort of ethno-supremacy with very, very violent economic policies for that are going to affect most the marginalized communities who are not part of the founding ethnic or racial myths of those nations. So black and brown people in the U.S., Muslims and other marginalized faiths or religions in Modi's India. Do you see any linking between sort of what the cynicism, I think actually the accuracy, cynicism's the wrong word, of someone like a Baldwin, and when we talk about neoliberalism, that it's not a coincidence that we see this co-rise of ethno-supremacy and increasingly violent economic politics? Is part of the appeal for their supporters that they can do the violence that's sort of inherent in the supremacist myths of a lot of these nations, that you can be a white supremacist far more easily under a neoliberalism than, let's say, a socialism?
Yeah, no, absolutely. The two things are very clearly connected to me. I mean, perhaps the easiest way to understand this is by making reference to the category that Nancy Fraser proposed of progressive new liberalism, because I think it actually captures very well a certain moment, the moment of expansion of neoliberal globalization in the 90s and 2000s all the way up to the 2008 crisis, where you have two processes that are in a lot of places around the world. You have two processes that are combined at the same time, which are on the one hand an economic policy that, to use NASA Fraser's terms, distributive policy that's 100% neoliberal. So it's destroying the lives of lots of people and communities because the factories they used to work in were offshore, because the social networks on which they depended have been dismantled, because the welfare they could access is shrinking, etc., etc. But you combine that with, and this was part to Will Davis, who's a sociologist at Goldsmiths in London, describes this as the period of normative new liberalism. The way in which those transformations are ideologically compensated was with what Nancy Fraser calls a meritocratic a politics of recognition. So for certain groups who'd been historically excluded and marginalized, there is this promise that, oh, if you're Black but you work hard, now you can make it. If you're a woman but you work hard, now you can make it. And this is part of the ideological legitimation of what's happening. It's like, this is how you present, this is part of how you present new liberalism as normative and not just this alien force that's destroying the lives of a bunch of people, but is actually, providing opportunities and improving the lives of other people. And but it's also how people like Clinton, like Tony Blair, etc., could attract some social movements or some people in progressive elements in society to a coalition that was at heart new liberal. Those two things are running in parallel. On the one hand, there's the public discourse that, oh, we're improving the lives of minorities. On the other hand, there's the destruction, the havoc that's being wreaked by neoliberalism constantly. And that havoc accelerates after 2008, when a bunch of people who had their jobs, who owned their houses, suddenly lose it all. What the far right does is associate those two things. What the far right does is basically say, the reason why you lost your social standing, the reason why you lost the material conditions that made it possible for you to access your rights, that the reason for that is because your rights were being taken away from you and being given to all these other people, being given to Black people, being given to women, being given to gay and trans people, so on, Indigenous people, so on, and migrants, so on and so forth. That is, I think, the rhetorical magic of the far right, to create that association in the minds of other people. And white supremacy is among many other things, a regime of visibility. It determines how people perceive the world. So white people who've grown up with certain privileges that were premised on the denial of rights to black people or to indigenous people or to generally non-white people, they won't perceive these privileges as being based on the denial of rights to other people. They will perceive those privileges as just being their rights. So what happens if you're in the Rust Belt is that, or, you know, in many, not to make any easy stereotypes, in any of the other regions in poor white America that have progressively swung to the right in the last however many years. But the Rust Belt is a great example because it used to be in these places you used to have strong unions, you used to have people who were committed to more progressive forms of politics, etc. But what is happening is at the same time you're losing your job, you're losing your social standing, you're losing the recognition that you had in the community, you're losing all the rights that you could access, and you're also losing what you perceived as being your right to tell jokes about black people, because now people won't let you tell jokes like that because, you know, people don't have a sense of humor anymore, blah, blah, blah. And what the far right does is associate those two things and say the reason why you've lost all those other things is because you also lost this privilege, which obviously is only a privilege from the perspective of the other whose rights had to be denied in order for you to have this. For someone like you who was born and grew up with this privilege, that is just your right. You have the right to tell those jokes, or you have the right to say you don't want black people or gay people moving into your community, and so forth.
So you said something that really interested me, and you talked about sort of the politics of visibility. When you're thinking of the billionaires who back a Bolsonaro or a Trump, and many did, Stephen Ross, very wealthy Jewish backer of Trump, you would see people like sort of Herman Cain, a very prominent black supporter of Trump. One of the largest communities that he made a commitment over and over to wooing outside of evangelical Christians were right-wing Indian American supporters who were huge financial backers of his campaign in America. And I'm wondering for the people who are not in the Rust Belt, who dine in a San Francisco or a New York or an LA or a Boston, is part of the politics of visibility why they're disgusted with the multicultural aspects of neoliberalism when they go to their favorite lobster roll restaurant on the coast and they see a family who's brown or a family who's Asian or a family speaking Spanish or a family speaking Mandarin? Do you feel for the wealthy who are backing a lot of these campaigns of disinformation, who are linking up these far-right groups, who are throwing themselves behind a white supremacy that seems far more destabilizing than the sort of stable return on investment of, you know, like a Biden-esque neoliberalism? Do you feel or have you thought at all about this politics of visibility and the anger of that the elites who support far-right ethno-fascists have of literally, what are you doing here? Is that a lot of what's going on for them?
It could well be. It could well be that there's a strong element of that. You know, it's a. I think there's. It's fairly well documented phenomenon in history that certain groups who manage to, you know, certain groups once they've managed to ascend socially, go out of their way to dissociate themselves from their origins so that they won't be mistaken for, you know, the social milieu where they came from. But to be honest, in relation to the super rich backers of people like Trump and Bolsonaro, I think it's mostly about wealth. I think it's mostly about the fact that they realize that what we have, the economic system we have at present is no longer sustainable in any sense of the word. There is neither enough capitalism nor enough world anymore for everyone. And I think they realize that, and I think they're getting ready for that, at the risk of sounding extremely dark. I honestly believe that it's been the trend for a while, since the 80s, since the 90s, that there's a growing contingent of people who cannot be absorbed by capitalism anymore. So people who are structurally unemployed or underemployed, and there is no perspective, things being as they are, for them to ever be absorbed in any other way than at best as underemployed. So there's no economic interest in sustaining the lives of these people anymore. And on top of that, you have the growing realization of climate change and the effect that that's going to happen in terms of, you know, making less and less areas inhabitable and disrupting the production of food, etc., etc. So things being what they are, if everything remains the same, I think in the not so distant future, we may very well see neoliberalism as having been just a transition towards a long period of transition towards the situation in which the global ruling class will just say, look, there's no longer enough world or economy for everyone, and surplus populations will be left to fend for themselves in a world in which resources are diminishing. Obviously, that's not... If our systems remain democratic, that shouldn't be politically sustainable, because you're effectively saving a tiny fraction of the population and just leaving everyone else to fight for their survival in a world that's ever that offers ever less resources for that survival. One of the things that the super rich have found in the far right is precisely perversely is the possibility of finding some measure of popular support for a transition towards that situation, for a transition towards a system in which the vast majority of the population in the world has simply been abandoned by both the economy and the state.
And so you, to sort of close on this last quote, you said the following in your Public Books article, and we'll end with maybe one or two questions on this quote. To those who believe radical change was inevitable after 2008, underestimated two factors. First, we did not foresee the extent to which our political systems have been inured to running on low legitimacy. In the absence of any sustained challenge to their power, elites seem to trust their capacity to continually outmaneuver the majority of the population, regardless of whether or not they are trusted. Second, we fail to appreciate the sheer force of inertia produced in neoliberalism's disciplinary mechanisms, none of which are more powerful than the crisis itself. The first question I have is very short. In what ways do you think policing has been the main gauze over the gaping wound of this illegitimacy? And then the second question I have is about the language we use about the world ending. And I've sort of hinted at this a lot, you know, bringing up Baldwin, I think Malcolm X, and other sort of thinkers. For me, Raj Patel also comes to mind here. Part of the actions of the elite come from the fact that I am concerned with a lot of the how nations were founded, the ethno-supremacy upon which many base their primal identities on, that sort of all elites know how to do is to end the world, or literally for them, since time immemorial, that's all they've been doing, ending the world of the indigenous, ending the world of Africans, ending the world of the poor. And when we say things like the end of the world, is it very important to note for like a Elon Musk who's building, you know, apartheid-powered rockets to Mars for his rich friends, or when we look at a Peter Thiel who, Jacinda Senda, I can't pronounce her name, but the New Zealand leader is allowing the scum of the earth in people like Peter Thiel to purchase passports after he's helped fuel the rise of a far right that will devour all these nations. He'll be safely ensconced in climate change proof New Zealand. Policing, could you touch upon that? And then for this question of who the world will end for and who is doing the ending, could you elaborate a bit on that?
Well, in relation to the first question, I would say that absolutely. That is most definitely one of the main things that elites can bank on today. And this means if we go back to that observation that I made earlier between of the difference between the situation that we're in today with the extent of the asymmetry in military power between the police and anything that organized social movements could muster, and how like the idea of arming the people was perceived by Machiavelli, by the founding fathers in the US who were drawing precisely from this tradition of Republican democratic thinking. So if we go back to this idea that at the start of modernity, some thinkers established a relationship between the symmetry of military power and democracy, that in a situation in which there was too big an asymmetry of military power, democracy would be corrupted or democracy was at risk. This would mean that the demand to abolish the police has not only all the, which is one of the most important demands coming out of social movements today, not only has all the other connotations that we know it has about white supremacy, about stopping the killing of the disproportionate killing of people of color, etc., but it also has a bearing on the democratic question, abolishing at the very least, or dismantling, or at the very least, diminishing the military might of police always also has a bearing on democracy, because ultimately, as Machiavelli knew very well, one of the key questions for the health of a democracy is whether the ruling class, whether the rulers are afraid of the ones who they rule over. And obviously, if they have extremely well-armed police at their disposal, they won't be. In relation to the second question, I mean, yeah, it's absolutely no, going back to what I was just saying about, you know, where I think the world is headed, all things remaining equal. And I actually think COVID has accelerated this trend in several ways. We can see that it's absolutely no coincidence that all the Silicon Valley people are buying land in New Zealand and discussing how to go live in Mars or upload their brains onto supercomputers, because they know very well what's coming. They can see very well. They are fully aware of what's coming, and they're looking for ways in which they can guarantee that even if the world ends for pretty much everyone else, it won't end for them. They will survive. So at the risk of being sounding even more dark than I sounded just a few minutes ago, I could say what I once said to a friend with whom I was discussing the problem of how to ground an emancipatory project in the absence of a perspective of future redemption or of indefinite perfectibility or just the idea of a future altogether. At the limit, if it comes to it, the one egalitarian demand left will be make the rich die at the same rate as the poor.
If I could ask you just as a PS, does the downfall of the PT point and add more sort of real world weight to what you're saying, where we need to believe when a Bolsonaro says I'm a fascist, or a Trump is clapping at his baying minions, that we need to just believe that's who those people are, that we cannot go the route of Toussaint Louverture, come so close to revolution and then compromise out of principle. How does this sort of recent history of the PT informed some of the, I think, very realistic pessimism that you've outlined today?
It definitely has had a bearing on what I think today, in the sense that both in the sense that the situation took a really bad turn really fast in Brazil. What happened to PT was not so much it died, but something like that short story by Edgar Allan Poe, where a guy gets hypnotized just at the moment when he's dying, and then the corpse is kept talking for several months until they finally, the corpse actually finally asks to be let go, and then when they unmake the hypnotism or the magnetism, the body just rots immediately. That was kind of what happened in Brazil. Like, suddenly we realized that it had been rotten for a while, and this is why things could take such a sharp turn so quickly. But yeah, I think I would say the greatest lesson in Brazil, the two lessons in Brazil were: A, you need to have a sense, even if you're seeking compromise, even if you're trying to do things in a gradual way, etc., you must know where you're going. You must have a clear idea of somewhere you're heading. Otherwise, you're simply not going anywhere. And the other lesson is to adapt a Chinese saying: if you ride a tiger, you must have a plan for dismounting. If you choose to travel with your enemy for part of the way, i.e. if you choose to strike a symbiotic relationship with your enemy for part of the way, you best be sure that your enemy will have a plan to get rid of you at some point down the line, and you best have a plan of your own. This was actually a point that a Polish economist called Michał Kalecki made as far back as 1943, in which he very presently predicted what was going to happen to Keynesianism in a paper called Political Aspects of Full Employment, which he said, well, what's going to happen is the working class will get too strong, the ruling class will get too weak vis-a-vis the working class, and they're going to rescind their support for the ruling class are going to rescind their support for the Keynesian compact. That's exactly what happened in the 70s. So even if you choose a reformist route, you have to know where you're going, and you have to be ready for the fact that those with whom you're trying to establish a cordial or a symbiotic relationship with will remain your enemy, and they will be out to get you whenever they can.
Well, Rodrigo, this was an enormously informative conversation. I know you have a book coming out, and you posted the dog on fire meme for being an author with a book coming out in 2021. Is there anything that we touched upon today that you're going to address in more detail in your book? Or could you, as a conclusion, just sort of give us a preview of that for people who are going to read even if their house is on fire?
Well, this book is an attempt to, it's among several other things, this book is an attempt to draw a balanced sheet of the movements of the last decade, and what happened to them, and why the decade that seemed to be moving in one direction, and direction of an expansion of democracy and a more egalitarian economic system, suddenly turned sharply in the opposite direction, and we suddenly discovered this phenomenon that we thought had long disappeared from history. And suddenly we had fascism at our doorstep again. But it's doing that, it's drawing that balance sheet from the point of view of a theory of political organization. Although people talk about organization, people talk about the need to organize a lot, there's actually the field of political organization is actually surprisingly under-theorized. There isn't a theory of political organization as such in the way in which I mean it, which is basically an attempt to think political organization in all the different forms it can take, and to describe all these different forms and the way they function in ways that pose problems that will be common to everyone, regardless of whether they're coming from an anarchist tradition or whether they're coming from a Marxist perspective, etc., etc. So you get theories of social movements, you get theories of the party, but you don't get theories of political organization in the sense that I'm trying to provide with this book. And the purpose of doing that is to try and get people out of several dead ends to which I think many of the movements of the last decade ended up coming. In the US for sure, and with Occupy certainly in the 2013 protests in Brazil. So it's an attempt to pose the problems that people will face when they become active, when they become involved in social mobilization, and they have to organize themselves in some way or another. It's an attempt to try and pose these problems in ways that gets us out of sterile debates between verticalism and horizontalism. The dead ends into which I've seen many activists get themselves time and again. So basically that's what it is. I swear to God, it's more exciting. It sounds terribly dry when I put it in this way. I swear to God, it's more exciting than that. But yeah, that's what it will be. And obviously the best possible reception that I could imagine for it is if we actually have an upsurge of mobilization again very soon at the start of this decade, maybe at the 10-year anniversary of the Arab Spring, and that it can be useful to the people who become involved in those mobilizations, to the people who become involved in those movements, if it actually helps, if it illuminates their practice in ways that is helpful and productive for them.